Hezbollah and Israel stepped to the brink of war. Three died in a terrorist attack at a diversity festival in Germany. And Britain is choosing a military alliance with Germany over a relationship with Donald Trump. So let's get stuck right in. Sunday morning was one of those now increasingly common days where you kind of wake up, check the news, and think, oh wow, is this the start of World War III? I saw that Hezbollah and Israel were fighting at a level dramatically higher than anything that we've seen from those two since October 7th. And Hezbollah is a massively more capable terrorist group than Hamas. It looked like a major war might be about to break out. Well, now the dust has settled, the fog of war has wafted away, we can get a clearer picture of what was going on. And so to help us see that picture, I'm joined by our Middle Eastern correspondent, Mihailo Zekic.
Hello.
So what is the story about what happened on Sunday morning?
Yes, as you mentioned, Israel and Hezbollah had one of their largest skirmishes since the October 7th war started. How large? Well, that Sunday, Israel sent about 100 fighter jets into Lebanese territory to bomb 40 locations and destroyed what they called thousands of rockets or rocket launchers. And then 30 minutes after that, hundreds of those rockets ended up crossing from Lebanon into Israel, not just rockets, but also drones. It was a two-wave attack into Israeli territory, mainly targeting military targets. But the way that everything played out with how Hezbollah launched this and leading up to it, even though we've been seeing them fight each other almost on a daily basis, this attack was unique. One of the reasons, as I mentioned, was a two-wave attack. The rockets were sent earlier, mainly to overwhelm Israel's Iron Dome system, followed by a second wave of suicide drones that were zeroing on two military bases near Tel Aviv. One member of Israel's Navy died. It could have been a lot more catastrophic.
And one of these bases was reputed to be like Mossad headquarters, is that right?
Yeah, and another reason why everyone was focusing on this so much was because of this was, according to Secretary General of Hezbollah Hassan Nasrallah, the long-awaited response that Hezbollah was going to give for the assassination of Fuad Shukr, which we've talked about on this program before.
Right, this is kind of what we finished up Friday's show going, but like, is there going to be a major war with Hezbollah? What's their response going to be? How is Iran's new leadership? That's what this seemed like. This is what everyone's been waiting for. How is Hezbollah going to respond to the death of this major terrorist commander that was killed about a month ago?
Indeed. Now, people are looking at this thinking, okay, this attack was a lot less scary than what we anticipated. Like 200 to 300 projectiles doesn't sound that big in terms of some of the things we've seen before, like with Iran's attack in April and that kind of thing. Some people are saying, okay, looks like Hezbollah is trying to de-escalate the situation. Israel, for its part, hasn't retaliated yet. Looks like we're getting some calm on the northern border. And maybe that's the case. Nasrallah himself said in his speech afterwards that we've done everything according to plan. But you have to remember that the attack could have been a lot bigger if Israel hadn't preempted what was going to happen. This is what Simon Whistler on his online show War Graphics said about this attack.
Successful or not, the mere fact that Hezbollah was poised with thousands of rocket tubes on the Israeli border indicates that it's not just trying to posture with a series of empty threats. Even in a hypothetical world where Hezbollah was simply placing its rockets there and privately held no intent to fire them, Hezbollah still would have showed that it was all right with Israel believing such an attack was coming and probably engaging in hostilities as a result. That would kick off the same violent cycle anyhow, and the far more likely possibility is that Hezbollah put its thousands of rocket tubes in position because it did intend to use them.
As he mentioned there, like, even if everything that transpired on Sunday was a bit calmer and was like a lot less scary than what people were thinking, Hezbollah had plans for something much bigger, and if those original plans went forward, I mean, what, thousands of rockets, according to the IDF? That would have been a pretty big excuse for an actual full-on war between Israel and Hezbollah. And as far as Israel would be concerned, it'd be a pretty big provocation to try and look the other way to. And the indication is, again, who knows what they were thinking, but that Hezbollah was prepared to go all out for this, and that this could have very well erupted, even if it was through maybe rash decisions by some lower level people on the ground, into a full scale war with Lebanon. We came very, very close to seeing the Middle Eastern conflict expanded in a major way on Sunday.
And when we kind of woke up and saw, okay, all flights in and out of Tel Aviv have been canceled, I mean, that's kind of what it looked like, why it looked like was happening. So, you know, we could sit here and speculate and kind of go back and forth a little bit on what's going to happen next. Ultimately, though, we really can just speculate on that. Where we do have the more sure word of Bible prophecy is Lebanon's long-term future. And we are expecting some major changes there.
Yes, the prophecy that I went to this time last week, Psalm 83, we talked about some of these Arab countries like the Gulf states, like Jordan, perhaps getting into some sort of alliance with Israel that in turn ends up leading into Europe. That prophecy also, verses 6 and 7, mentions Gebal and Tyre. Tyre's a city in Lebanon right now. It still exists. Gebal is another word for Byblos, which again is another city in Lebanon. Lebanon is a part of this alliance.
And that's an alliance that's going to ally with a European power and initially will be opposed to this king of the south, this Muslim king of the south led by Iran that Europe will be opposing. And so, yeah, Lebanon is going to be in a European camp. Right now, Hezbollah certainly is very much in the Iranian camp. They're an Iranian puppet, basically.
Exactly. They're also a very unpredictable and somewhat even, say, weak puppet. They are, for all intents and purposes, the Lebanese government, but they're also... And Lebanon itself is in a state of, like, abject poverty. Its currency has devalued so much.
Lebanon's the weak puppet, you're saying, not Hezbollah.
Well, Hezbollah has a lot of military power, but in regards to their control on the ground, everybody knows that they're partly mostly the reason of why things are so bad in Lebanon. There's a lot of people that are sick of them. Lebanon has a huge Christian population that never liked them in the first place. Their power hold in Lebanon is a lot more tenuous than they'd like many people to believe.
And so we're watching for them to switch sides. Mm-hmm. This is a very specific forecast. Mr. Flurry, he talked about Lebanon being the linchpin of the Psalm 83 alliance. Like, they're going to play a very major role in the formation of this alliance and of Europe coming in there and creating this alliance of Arab nations, because Lebanon is part Christian and part Muslim. Mm-hmm. And because they have a very strong Christian minority, which is completely absent from a lot, you know, like Egypt, the Coptic minority there is dramatically smaller, for example. And then, you know, you've got other places, you know, Jordan barely has a Christian population at all. So they're going to play this key role in Europe moving into the Middle East. And that's not something necessarily that is immediately evident in the news, but it's a very specific, very testable forecast that you can watch.
Well, I think the big reason why we're focusing this prophecy with this event is that Lebanon is unstable and Lebanon is on the verge of war, whether that war involves Israel itself or some other outside player, we don't know yet. But this is what our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, said on a 2015 Key of David program.
So that means there's going to be now a civil war, a bloody civil war in Lebanon for control of Lebanon. And you're going to see Lebanon and the European power prevail in that battle. You're going to see that.
This is what informs our coverage of Lebanon. We're watching for conditions to boil down to a civil war. If war were to erupt with Israel, that would be a pretty big upset in Lebanese society, something that the Christian minority could take advantage of, something that could see a massive uprising against Hezbollah. But even if that doesn't happen, there's still so unstable in Lebanon that there are plenty of different excuses that people that have it in for Hezbollah could use to get rid of them. Right now, the potential war with Israel is the big story everybody's watching for. This could very well play a big part in it. We don't know, as you said, but it is certainly something we're watching for. And if our viewers would like to learn more, we have an article Mr. Flurry wrote in 2020, right after the famous Beirut blast, that the culprits still haven't been brought to justice on it. And by the culprits, I mean Hezbollah. The article is called Why We Told You to Watch Lebanon. That's Why We Told You to Watch Lebanon. It is Again, it's a little bit old, but the material in there is more relevant now than ever.
So they're going to switch. We don't necessarily know when. I think you look at what's going on in Israel, and it's pretty much unsustainable. Like, you've got tens of thousands of Israelis aren't able to live in their homes because of Lebanon's raining rockets down on them. There's going to have to be a reckoning. Whether that happens, whether Israel waits until after the November election or after a new president to be inaugurated, or whether Hezbollah waits, you know, they may well do these things. But I think what you made a compelling case of there is the status quo is unsustainable.
Exactly.
It is going to change. The Bible also tells us that it's going to change, and it tells us how it's going to change. So that is an important event to keep watching. Now we'll be shifting to another important Middle Eastern country that also begins with the letter L. Sorry, we're down to Sesame Street style segues today. That's about the best I could do. But I think you had some big news from Libya that you wanted to bring us.
Yes, on Monday, Libya announced it'll be shutting down most of its oil exports. And when I say Libya, I mean one of the factions that's currently in Libya that happens to control most of the oil exports. Libya is a bit of a basket case. But either way, it still impacts the economy of the country as a whole, and it most importantly impacts their export relations with some of their neighbors. The main reason why this got the way it is right now is some background. There's two main governments in Libya. One controls Tripoli and the West. It's the more internationally recognized one. And then there's another one in the East controlled by a warlord named Khalifa Haftar. And he controls most of the oil fields, but he also enjoys not much diplomatic recognition.
But he's the one that's supported by Turkey and Russia, is that correct?
Yep. But as far as like the West, the UN goes, it's the Tripoli government that's the legitimate one. One compromise they've been sort of had to keep Libya functioning as some kind of society is that they both share the central bank there, which is the only institution or government institution in the country that has access to foreign currency and currency swaps and that kind of thing, which for a country whose basically only exports are oil and African migrants to Europe, you could see why control of the central bank would be pretty important. At this point, the central bank is sort of more under the sway of the Eastern government, which go figure, that's where most of the revenue is coming from. The Western government's had a bit of a beef with that. They've apparently kidnapped some officials there and are now trying to unilaterally depose the governor there. And the Eastern government is basically seeing this as, this is just a power grab. They want to control the money supply. We're not going to play ball with it. We're shutting down our oil production, all of it. Libya produces over 1 million barrels of oil a day, and 70% of that is with the Eastern government. As far as export goes, you mentioned Russia. Russia has a huge stake in a lot of those oil fields. Their mercenaries are one of the reasons Haftar is able to stay in power. Libya is one of Europe's biggest suppliers of oil. And as Europe tries to transition away from Russian fossil fuels, Libya and that part of the Mediterranean in general is becoming a more important place for Europe to invest in. So you can imagine the ripple effect in this is going to be huge throughout not just like North Africa, but the wider world.
And this is another country that we're watching for some very specific prophesied trends. I mean, the Bible gives us two groups of allies that are going to clash. It tells us Daniel chapter 11 is a pivotal prophecy for understanding the Middle East. And it tells us that there's going to be this clash between a European king of the north and radical Islam led by Iran. And you put that together with Psalm chapter 83, that lists an alliance that has never happened before in history. And there's several aspects of Psalm 83 that overlap with Daniel 11. And so that gives us the list of one set of allies and tells us, well, Lebanon is going to be firmly in the European camp. We kind of have the opposite situation with Libya.
Yes, exactly. Daniel 11 verses 40-43 mention the countries in the Middle East that are going to be opposing this alliance. And for decades, Mr. Fleury has pointed to Iran being the king of this alliance, being the head of it, and radical Islam being the main glue that brings these countries together. Verse 43 talks about Europe, under the name of the king of the north, vanquishing Iran's allies, and it includes Libya and Ethiopia. And you look at Libya today, I think its population is something like 5 million. It's not a functioning state. It has, like, you know, it has some strategic value, but Libya doesn't make the news too much these days. It's almost like an afterthought with all these other conflicts we've been talking about, like Lebanon. Why is Libya so important? Well, here's what geopolitical analyst Peter Zeihan said just about this current crisis.
Hope is that there might be someone in Europe, France or Italy most notably, who decides to go in, knock heads together, and basically just take over the fields and run the country themselves as a colony. We're not there yet. We don't have energy shortages in Europe at the moment, and they've managed to find a lot of ways to adapt to Russian stuff going offline. And Libya, 1 million barrels a day, it's not that that's insignificant, but it's not enough of a shock to cause a political or a military reaction out of the European countries. But it is a little bit more pressure. So if something were to happen to, say, the Persian Gulf, which thank God has been one of the most stable parts of the world these last couple of years, then we're in a different world.
So you can see even he sees that if problems like this happen with Libya centered around the oil trade, Europe might be forced to intervene, especially if this ends up engulfing the rest of the Middle East. And that's exactly what we're watching for as well. This is what Mr. Fleur wrote in his book, The King of the South, quote, "So you need to watch Libya and Ethiopia. They are about to fall under the heavy influence or control of Iran, the King of the South. That is why they are subdued in the King of the North's victory. Why would Iran be so interested in gaining control over Libya and Ethiopia?" Further down, he writes, "They are on the two seas that comprise the most important trade route in the world. This could give Iran virtual control of the trade through those seas. Radical Islam could stop the flow of essential oil to the U.S. and Europe," end quote. And that's exactly, at least in a microcosm, what we're seeing in Libya right now. We may not necessarily see Iran's fingerprints over this. We may see Europe concerned with more pressing issues like an Israel-Lebanon war blowing up, but it's still on people's minds, and even analysts in the world can see where this can lead. And there's a lot that has to happen in this part of the world before we see Daniel 11 fulfilled, before we see this King of the South bloc firmly made, but the seeds of it are already being sown, even if it's not necessarily making the nightly news in every Western city, even if it might not necessarily seem the most important thing in the world, it's still there, and it's still going to impact the world in a major way.
And it could all happen very quickly.
Yes.
And I think that's why we're focusing on some of these stories. I think the news this week, as in a lot of weeks, I mean, it's generally pretty bad. You know, brink of war with Israel. We're going to get into some stabbings that went on in Europe. There's a lot of negative headlines. But there's tremendous hope in putting those negative headlines within context of Bible prophecy. And you look at what we've talked about already in the Middle East. And what we just really wanted to show you is all of these are happening according to a plan that is laid out in the Bible. This is not the world falling apart into chaos. This is all happening according to God's plan. They are negative, yes. And there is a lot of suffering that goes with some of these news stories, but God is allowing it to happen as part of his plan for all mankind. And as part of his plan to bring a new world, a much better world, very, very soon. So remember that with all of these events, that there are very specific prophecies that you can look at, that you can watch, and as you see them fulfilled, you can grow in faith and see that all of this is leading to what God wants it to lead to, rather than just happenstance or complete chaos. At the end of the day, the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, as it says in the book of Daniel. And we need Bible prophecy to remind us of that fact. And this last story that I want to talk about from the Middle East, this is kind of the one that has gotten me the most irritated and frustrated. And again, it's always good to remember that God is allowing these events, as aggravating and at times even depressing and discouraging as they may be. So tell us about this final Middle Eastern story, Simon.
Yeah, so on August 28th, the U.S. Departments of State and Treasury put sanctions on Hashomer Yosh, which is an Israeli NGO that basically provides security services to farms and other settlements in the West Bank or Judea and Samaria, as they're known in Israel. This is a bit of an interesting one. Stories like this pop up like now and again. Obviously, Israelis and Palestinians living in side-by-side quarters are going to have some scuffles every now and then. It's nothing new. But the particular incident that they're sanctioning for, this happened in February. You know, they've had half a year to do something about this. Why are they putting sanctions in now? And not only that, they've already sanctioned the farm that they with this incident where some Palestinians were forcibly like kept out of a village. Like, that farm was already sanctioned. Why are they going after the security service in general? And why did they wait so long for this? And why is no one, on the contrary, focusing, say, more attention on some other U.S. allies that maybe are doing some things that the current administration doesn't like? Like, why aren't Ukrainian soldiers being sanctioned for stopping Russians from getting back to their villages in Kursk? Why is nobody making the news about problems going on in Kashmir in India or some of these other things? You could see there's, it's like an out-of-the-blue focus for what's going on in the West Bank, what's going on in Israel, even though the West Bank, comparatively speaking, has actually been pretty, I don't want to say peaceful, but like not nearly the kind of unrest you're seeing, say, in Gaza or on the northern border, as we talked about. Well, this is what Michael Doran, who's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, he wrote an Argus 12 expose, really, for the Tablet magazine, where he claimed that through his contacts within the U.S. government, through some of these connections he had when he was a member of the government, he was able to confirm that the White House has established a basically sanctions team coordinating between the State Department, between the Treasury, these same institutions we're talking about now, between the National Security Council, to every now and then start up sanctions against Israeli communities, especially those in the West Bank, regardless of whatever they've done, but mainly for the purpose of keeping scandal in the news for Israel, keeping scandal in the news for Benjamin Netanyahu, making him look bad every now and then. And specifically, according to his sources, that this sanctions team was about to prepare something to be launched after we've seen retaliation for all these assassination of Islamists that Israel's done, which is what we've seen now just a few days later. And so the big takeaway, I think, of this is, like, no matter what the minutia is of West Bank politics, it really has nothing to do with what's going on in there. It's being used as a weapon against the current Israeli government. And it's one that, I mean, most of us don't live in the Middle East. Most of us get our news media from sources citing the Treasury Department and all these other official groups. It's a pretty easy story to control the narrative on. And it's basically using public opinion as a weapon against Netanyahu. And we've seen this kind of thing before with the Biden administration, with the Obama administration before him. And it shows that even as we're getting into an election year, even as there might be a new administration in Washington, the current government is doubling down on its efforts. And if they're doing things like this, you can be sure there's a lot of other stuff they're doing to try and pressure Netanyahu out as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is a group of volunteers that protect Israeli farms and livestock, and they're being treated like war criminals. And this is part of a deliberate and concerted effort on behalf of the Biden administration to try and push this narrative of, okay, yes, Hamas are bad, but Israel's just as bad, that there is guilt on both sides, and so we shouldn't support one side or the other. This isn't a battle between good and evil. There's fault everywhere, and it's completely false. And yeah, look, nobody is perfect. There was never a perfect side or a perfect army in any human conflict ever. But you have a level of evil in Hamas that Israel is not even close to. And so what they're trying to do is demonize Israel this way. And so they set up this whole new branch, or this whole new way of doing sanctions, bypassing all of the old rules and restrictions about sanctions, you know, like how sanctions are put in place and strict legal criteria and having to show wrongdoing and things like that. And you've got some people they put sanctions on where they put sanctions on someone that Israel has already sent to jail. Like, what is the point in that? They've already been punished way more than the U.S. sanctions are going to.
Well, not just that, but you notice a lot of the media reports, especially some of those more connected, say, with these causes, with these groups being sanctioned, they always put they're supported by Itamar Ben-Gavir and Bezalel Smotrich, these two ministers from Jewish Nationalist Party that a lot of the leftist media likes to portray as being neo-Nazis, basically, or far-right extremists, even though they're not the ones being sanctioned. But every time these sanctions come up, and again, you see these guys' names associated with them, it's almost like they're trying to sanction the Israeli government ministers without actually doing so. What's that going to cause? That's it's pretty obvious. They're trying to cause a coalition crisis. They're trying to cause something to split up. And again, these guys are the reason Netanyahu is still in power. It's not hard to connect the dots.
Yeah, they're trying to do that. But I think they're also, so they put sanctions on somebody that's already been sent to jail, which is pointless. They've already been sent to jail. But they don't tell, like, they just want to make it look like, see, Israel's got these big war criminals too. They're just trying to publicize the fact
exactly
that someone's done so. Or then you get a group like, this is a group that just exists to protect Jewish property. And the Biden administration says, you try to protect Jewish property, we're going to treat you like a war criminal. Why? Well, just because we don't agree with where that property is. It is absolutely abhorrent. And it exposes the anti-Israel, anti-Netanyahu bias of this administration. And I think sometimes that's on display. And I think sometimes Joe Biden tries to present himself as this longtime friend of Israel. I've been in the Senate for decades. I've always supported it. I mean, this shows the true colors of those running the United States, and it's not really Joe Biden. I think that is very clear anyway, regardless of what his personal views may or may not be. So it exposes the anti-Israel nature of this. And, you know, we've spent half the show on the Middle East already, so I think we'll have to move on. But we do have a trumpet cover that has Benjamin Netanyahu on it. It has an article by both Mihailo and I that we wrote together that shows exactly why this administration and why the Obama administration, that really this is the third term of, is so anti-Israel. And there is a very clear, definite bias and agenda here. We had a whole show on that a few weeks ago. If you didn't see that and you want to know more about that, go watch that show that we did that really goes through and, you know, that Benjamin Netanyahu was a kind of watchman exposing a lot of evil that's going on in Iran, and then also from America's support for Iran. And a lot of the reason why he's being targeted and they're trying to bring down his coalition is exactly because of that. And it exposes a spiritual reality within the United States that hates Israel in the Middle East, but that hates this global legacy of spiritual Israel that includes Britain, that includes America, these descendants of Israel, and it wants to blot out that legacy. And so it attacks the Jews in the Middle East, and it attacks key parts of British history, American history, culture, and tries to make out those countries as being evil as well. And it's no coincidence that this animosity against Israel is coming from exactly the same source as the animosity towards traditional British and American values. So that's also an important story. And I think that sanctions announcement sheds a bit of light on that. Well, I also had a few stories from Europe that I wanted to bring you. We haven't heard from them yet. We're also joined by Andrew Miller and Jeremiah Jacques from the United States. You guys feel free to jump in if you have any comments on these stories, if it seems like I am monologuing too much. But the first that I wanted to mention was this stabbing where a Syrian migrant murdered three people and injured eight others at a pro-diversity celebration. This was some kind of concert basically to celebrate the 650th anniversary of the German city of Solingen. And they made it a celebration of diversity of all things. And this guy who pledged allegiance, it looks like, to the Islamic State came along and murdered three people. You know, he went on this stabbing spree. He was going through the throat, trying to kill as many people as possible. The premier of the state, Nordrhein-Westfalia, he called it an act of terror. And so this was on Friday last week. Too late for us to include it on the show. He went away. He turned himself in on Sunday, still covered in blood. He turned up and said, well, I'm the man you're looking for. He arrived in Germany in 2022. He claimed asylum. A Deutsche Presse Agentur said that his claim was denied, that he was due to be deported last year. For whatever reason, that didn't happen. And this has shed a light on Germany's migrant problems, that you've got a migrant that's been let in by the government from Syria, something that's very controversial. He wasn't deported. Again, it's very easy for immigrants to avoid deportation. And it's really brought this subject of immigration to the fore. The government's response has been absolutely underwhelming. Their focus as this has been crackdown on knives. So the vice chancellor, Robert Herbeck, he said, no one in Germany needs to have a knife in a public place, which I just find bonk. Like, I want to live in a society where I can just carry a Swiss Army knife around all the time. Britain, you can't do that. That's illegal. I think that's absolutely ridiculous nanny statism. Knives are useful tools. We need to deal with the people that have a, like, you can, maybe you can get rid of all the guns and you can practice a lot of gun control. You can't do that with, we use knives every day. You use knives for your dinner. The idea that we can rid society of knives is insane. But they don't, the current government doesn't want to deal with the problem of migration. They've decided, I guess, that even trying, that knife control is easier than dealing with the migrant crisis. But it's been a pretty noticeable shift in German rhetoric. You're having more in the mainstream now within Germany that are willing to speak out against this problem. The Friedrich, the leader of the Christian Social Union, he has come forward. He has talked about the need to clamp down on migrants. So as you see these kind of attacks, you know, watch for this to change German society. We've made this point before on this show. Whether you live in the United States, whether you live in the United Kingdom, whether you live in Britain, whether you live in France, there are genuine problems. There's a genuine migration crisis in all of these countries. And it is not wrong for people to be upset by migrant violence. It is not wrong for, you know, that doesn't make somebody a Nazi. But what you're seeing in a lot of these countries is the government in power, but then also lawyers, judiciary, the deep state, all of these gearing up behind migrants and migration policies and saying, if you want to change that, you are a racist, you are a Nazi, you know, you're a terrible person, and we cannot change it, and you've just got to live with it. And I think there are really dangerous associations with all of that in all of these countries. And for Britain and the United States, you're having this real risk of civil unrest, division, even civil war, as you're bringing in, importing violent migrants on a massive scale from all around the world, and then other people stand up and want to oppose that. But then you're having risks in Germany and France where, at least maybe that's changing this week, but within Germany, the only people that have been willing to stand up to the migrants have been the Alternative for Deutschland, this party where a lot of several members right at the top have made neo-Nazi comments and quite clearly have neo-Nazi worldviews. People are desperate for some kind of solution. They see these stabbings. Only the Alternative for Deutschland seems to be even talking about the issue. It's driving people towards those extremes, and it's turning German politics and society in that extreme direction. And that's a dangerous trend that we're seeing right now in Germany and across Europe.
Yes, it is really just amazing to me that the German government and governments across the Western world are letting this happen. We've obviously got a lot of migrant problems in the United States, more involving like drug cartels and Hispanic immigrants than Islamic immigration, but we do have some of that too. But I remember reading an article a few years ago by Melanie Phillips from over there in the UK with you, who made a really good point that says that when the government fails to defend the border, it's really violating the most basic social compact between the individual and the government. It's like whenever you're under a government, you do have to give up some amount of freedom in return for security. And so basically, like, we pay in Britain and America and Germany and countries around the world, we pay taxes. I give like roughly 10% of my income to the federal government in hopes that they're going to defend the border, so I don't have to worry about drug cartels and Islamic immigrants and other dangerous things. And so when the government fails to do that, they're not upholding their end of the deal and the social compact citizens have made it. And it makes it so citizens kind of have to take the law into their own hands and start defending themselves, which is very dangerous. It leads to like an anarchic situation. In Germany, especially, it seems to be worse in Germany than it is in America or England at the time, where, like you mentioned, there are these people joining the Alternative for Deutschland and other neo-Nazi parties because those parties are promising to take their tax dollars and use them to defend them from illegal immigrants like this. And obviously the Alternative for Deutschland and these other neo-Nazis, they're reprehensible parties, and I'm not defending anyone who joins them. But the fact that there are people who are joining them is to a large extent the fall of the current German government. If the German government would actually defend the border, defend people from radical Islamic terrorists and other things like that, then people would be less likely to join these radical parties. And so it is like the weakness of governments in Britain and in Germany and America that's leading this into a radical situation where there's rising crime, rising terrorism, rising violence, and people are having to try to figure out, like, well, what am I going to do if the government's not going to do anything? I've got some hard choices to make.
And that, I think, that's a great point. That's part of our message. And you're right. Like, if you're a German citizen or even a British citizen, like, well, yeah, who do you vote for to fix this? There doesn't really seem to be anyone. And that's kind of the point. There is no hope in man. And that God is allowing all of these events to see that our only hope isn't in a man-made political system, but it's repentance and turning to God, and that these are causing some genuine problems. I mean, within Germany, this is going to lead to the rise of a strong leader. And you can read more about that in our free book, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. There are a host of prophecies that tell us that this is an individual that is really going to dramatically shape German and world history. And you can see that appetite as you have, you know, a stabbing at a festival. That's leading to the appetite of having this strong man come along. And I think you see in a second story I wanted to talk about the dangerous tendencies within Europe. This is from France, where the founder of the messaging app Telegram was arrested over the weekend. And I think it was just Thursday we got the details as to what he was arrested for. And you know, this is some pretty heavy-handed and worrying treatment from France, where basically he was arrested for not regulating this messaging app the way that the French government wanted him to. And so the government is saying, well, you allowed kind of drug dealing and child pornography to go on this app. And then also they're saying that his company just ignored legal letters. And I guess, you know, whoever you are, if you ignore a jury summons letter or something like that, yeah, you are going to find yourself in pretty serious trouble pretty quickly if you start ignoring letters from the government. And so that's kind of their legal justification, I guess, is that his company hasn't been answering these letters. But you know, we're having the police come in and grab a guy as he touches down in France because he's not letting them censor what people are saying in a private messaging app. That really exposes something about Europe and the way that they want to dominate speech. I mean, Telegram is not Twitter. This is more, I don't use it, so I'm not as familiar with it. But it's more, say, like WhatsApp and communicating with groups that can be quite large groups, and then individual communication. And if you want to just let communication go on unfiltered by the government, they'll arrest you. That's what we saw in Europe. And earlier this year, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote, Europe is showing its authoritarian colors. And that is what we've seen quite dramatically in that. That article was called The EU's War on Free Speech, and he goes into this subject in more detail. And we talked about this on the show a few weeks ago, where he talked about Elon Musk trying to censor a discussion going on between a US political candidate and a US citizen on a US social network, you know, in the form of Elon Musk interviewing Donald Trump. And they wanted to be able to say, no, you can't do that. So they are, it reveals their authoritarian colors. We don't have that strongman that is dominating Europe yet, but the authoritarian spirit is there already. This desire for Europe to dominate what people can say all around the world, so to control their own citizens and then to spread that power beyond their own border, is there already. In this story, you see this spirit of the Holy Roman Empire rising in Europe. Really, that's what this is all about. And that's why we can't look at the rise of things like the Alternative for Deutschland and kind of see it as a German Donald Trump movement. It's not. There is a different spirit rising in Europe, and it wants to control what you say and what you think and what you believe. That is the direction that Europe is going. That's the direction that we saw in France this week. And that's a direction prophesied in Revelation chapter 17 that says this same empire that has repeatedly tried to control what Europeans see and think and believe, that is rising again right now in Europe. And as Britain sees this, that was the other story I wanted to hit from Europe this week. As Britain sees this happening, Britain is looking at that and saying, I want to get closer to that power. And that, I think, is another very disturbing news story from this week. So the new Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, he visited Germany for a couple of days this week. And he said basically that while he's doing that, he wants to have a new treaty with Germany or a new deal with Germany. And so there's trade deals that they want, but also a military relationship.
So we've talked about the substance of that today, and that will be ambitious. It will be wide-ranging, covering trade, the economy, defence, and many other issues. And the fact that we've agreed the substance, the ambition, and the pace of it today, I think, is very significant for both the UK and for Germany. And that's why I say it's a once-in-a-generation opportunity to take something of that order forward for both of our countries. When it comes to the wider reset with Europe, I'm absolutely clear that we do want a reset. I've been able to repeat that here today, a reset with Europe, a reset with the EU.
But he's going there. He wants more favourable treatment of British businesses within Germany. Germany wants it easier for young Europeans to live and work in the United Kingdom and maybe even study at British universities. The two of them talked about working together to cut migration. So at least there is some sense of mainstream politicians and even centre-left politicians waking up to what is going on in both of these countries. But it's the military aspect that caught my eye the most. This is what Reuters wrote about this. It said an Anglo-German defence partnership could resemble the Lancaster House Pact between Britain and France agreed in 2010, according to officials, with pledges to create a joint force and share equipment and nuclear missile research centres. So Britain could be looking at sharing nuclear technology with Germany. That Anglo-French partnership in 2010 was kind of that Lancaster House Pact was touted as this really close, intimate defence partnership. And they're saying, well, we could do the same thing with Germany now. A big reason that Britain is doing this is because of the specter of Donald Trump. And so Keir Starmer doesn't really want to get on well with Donald Trump. He feels like he doesn't want to, Britain's alliance with America, the so-called special relationship, this is a core part of Britain's security relationship. He doesn't want to have that kind of relationship with Donald Trump. And so he would rather turn to Germany. And so that's what he's doing now. He's getting ready in case Donald Trump comes back and paving the way for a military alliance with Germany. So this Holy Roman Empire is rising in Europe, and Britain is increasingly looking to this new Holy Roman Empire to come and solve its problems. And that is a dynamic that is also prophesied, that Britain would look to Germany as the solution to its problems. The Bible calls it a lover's relationship that Britain looks on and relies on Germany, and then Germany uses that to betray them and to double cross them. And that's something I wrote about in Europe and America. They've lost that loving feeling, an article that we've got on our website that can take you through all of the ways that this is prophesied. So again, I think we've covered, it was really hard this week to try and pick out what is the biggest news story, because there's quite a lot of news stories here. But instead, in kind of hitting quite a few of these stories, I just want you to see that all of these different details conform to this prophetic overview that we've been talking about for years, that the Bible has talked about for centuries. Because all of world events are unfolding according to God's plan for mankind. And he's allowing Britain to act as a silly dove, as it talks about in the book of Hosea, and make some foolish foreign policy decisions. But it's all about, it's all in the context of eventually it leading to the nation turning to him. So that was my rundown of some of the big news from Europe. As usual, this land war going on in Europe as well, in Ukraine with Russia, is a major story. And to get the latest developments on that, we can turn to Jeremiah.
Yes, Belarus is amassing troops along its border with Ukraine. That's really the big news this week. Belarus, of course, is Russia's closest ally in every sense of that word. Belarus has actually become essentially a Russian satellite in recent years, with Vladimir Putin being the main force that keeps the Belarusian dictator Alexander Lukashenko in power. And now it may be that Putin is planning to use this military that he indirectly controls in Belarus to open up a new front in his war on Ukraine. So Belarus appears to have about one third of its army now deployed to locations along the border with Ukraine. This would be about 16,000 troops, if that figure is accurate. And Belarus has also sent aircraft, air defense forces, and armory to the border. And some of these troops and weapons are in locations where Russian troops invaded Ukraine from back in 2022. Belarus, of course, at that time let the Russians use its territory as kind of a staging ground for a major part of the invasion of Ukraine. But this time around, Belarus could go a big step further and lend, you know, not just its territory and bases to the Russian war effort, but its soldiers too. Now, it is also possible that this is just saber rattling and posturing that won't really go anywhere. Alexander Lukashenko is often crafty and unpredictable. He has a bit of a flair for the dramatic at times. And this is a very heavily mined area as well. The Ukrainians have their northern border areas just full of landmines. So it would not be an easy push for Belarus to invade through here. But at the same time, Putin may not give them a choice. You know, Putin is not squeamish about sending thousands and thousands of soldiers to certain death if he thinks that that will further his interests. And with Ukraine still deepening its push into Russian territory, and with Russia still unable to evict them, you can see why this would be an optimal time for Putin to open kind of a new front in the war and to use Belarus to do so. This could force the Ukrainians to redirect some of their limited manpower and firepower, and it could present some serious complications to the Ukrainians. So we'll just have to, you know, see what happens here. But on a related note, I also wanted to mention that Russia this week carried out its largest aerial attack on Ukraine of the entire war so far. This was on Monday evening and spanning into Tuesday morning. And the Russians fired more than 320 missiles and drones at civilian targets in several Ukrainian cities, including the capital. So just a stunningly large attack here. And it included Kinzhal hypersonic missiles, and it did a great deal of damage. The Russians managed to kill 8 Ukrainian civilians and injure dozens more. And they also disrupted a great deal of the electricity and water services in many of these cities. So we see that Russia still has plenty of firepower remaining, even more than 900 days into this war. And we see with the situation in Belarus that Russia may still have some surprise tactics and strategies up its sleeve as well.
Now, I feel like we've been making this point quite a bit on Trumpet World, that so many of these news events that we come back to from Asia, they all stem from one man, Vladimir Putin. And once again, we're kind of talking about what is Putin going to do? How far does his influence stretch? And this is something you wrote a longer article on that maybe on one of the Wednesday shows we can sit down and talk about in more detail, where there are quite a lot of people in the West looking at what is happening with Ukraine invading Russian territory. I saw one from Daniel Hannan, I think it was. You know, he's a commentator that I think I really respect. I think he has a lot of really great points on certainly British history and the rule of law and things like this. And his headline was something along the lines of Vladimir Putin is toast now because he has allowed this to happen. But based on the Bible, we're making a very different forecast, and what you're seeing in Belarus is a sign of that.
It's a very good point. Yes, it's true. This war has not gone the way that Vladimir Putin and the rest of Russia thought that it would. It hasn't been the easy conquest that they had calculated it would be. But Putin remains utterly dead set in his determination to conquer Ukraine. And Bible prophecy sheds some light on that determination. Ezekiel chapter 38 and actually chapter 39 as well are the main passages about this. They're about a Russian strongman. You were talking about a European strongman a moment ago, but these passages are about a Russian strongman who will actually, you know, be very much involved with that European strongman in some dramatic ways. But they talk about him, the Russian strongman, leading a huge block of Asian countries to war in the near future. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Furey says the Russian man described in these passages is none other than Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin. So, you know, we can't say for certain what will happen with these Belarusian troops that are now amassing and how that might play out. We can't say for certain what all of the exact outcomes of the whole war will be. But Mr. Fleury says we can be sure that however it all plays out, Putin will not be ousted, and he'll actually be growing far more powerful in the years ahead as he gets positioned to lead this future multinational army.
We've had some other big stories from Asia. I think another one that also kind of revolves around Vladimir Putin, this war in Ukraine.
That's true, yes. This one is very much related, and it is about North Korea's assistance for Russia's war. North Korea has become in some ways a vassal to both Russia and China in recent years. And now that Putin needs weapons for this war, the North has stepped up to help him as much as it can. This was a new report from South Korean officials. It says that they've been analyzing all the train containers that North Korea has shipped across the border to Russia over the last year or so. And these are new shipments, a type of shipments that were not happening before the war. And the North has now sent enough containers to hold more than 6 million artillery shells. So some very significant numbers there. And there's evidence for this in Ukraine as well. Many of the shells that have been fired at Ukrainian, you know, targets there are marked in a way that shows that they are North Korean in origin. And then it's not just shells, but missiles too. North Korea is sending dozens of ballistic missiles to Russia so that it can help Russia kill as many Ukrainians as possible for their crime of not wanting Ukraine to become a Russian vassal or satellite, the way nations like North Korea and Belarus are increasingly becoming. So just a short one there. And then another quick story about China's aggression. Not a week goes by that the Chinese don't antagonize some of their neighbors in very dangerous, very provocative ways. Normally, China picks on weaker countries in its periphery, like the Philippines or Vietnam or Taiwan or even Bhutan. But this week, they poked the samurai. This was actually a historical first. For the first time in history, the Chinese military violated Japan's territory. It was on Monday that China flew a military plane into Japan's airspace, and this forced Japan to scramble some F-35s. And it's just one more sign of how brazen and how antagonistic the Chinese bully has become.
Well, in the face of all of that and a world that is getting more dangerous, our top Anglo-American story revolves around how America's responding to that, Andrew.
Yeah, here in Anglo-America, obviously, a lot of the news coverage is still about the presidential campaign, but there is another big security problem in America that could really affect your life that you're not hearing much, and that's actually the decline of the U.S. Navy. There's actually only about 280 warships in the U.S. Navy right now, which is still pretty big, but it's lower than it's been since the 1930s, which was not a good time for naval security. If you look back at the past 200 years from the end of the Napoleonic Wars to the beginning of World War I, it was primarily the British Empire who made sure that the world's trade route stayed open. Then during like the 19-teens, 1920s, 1930s, there was 1940s, there was a bit of a free-for-all with two world wars where people just fought for control of the oceans and other parts of the globe. But since World War II, it's been the American Navy that fills that role that Britain used to fill. So if America's Navy is as weak as it's been since the 1930s, that's pretty concerning. They've done some projections to where they're saying that the American Navy's, it's probably only going to grow by like 20 ships in the next decade, while the Chinese Navy is going to grow by probably closer to 100 ships. So China is narrowing that gap. The latest naval reports say that actually China's shipbuilding capacity is 232 times greater than America's shipbuilding capacity. because we've closed down most of the shipyards. So if any of our ships get destroyed or even just get old and retired, America's really struggling to build enough ships to replace them. We're hoping we have enough naval ships to defend all the trade routes around the world, and that's just not holding up because now we've got a war in Ukraine and we've got a war in Israel. So America's got 11 aircraft carriers. A lot of them have been redeployed to the Indian Ocean and the Mediterranean Sea just to help make sure things don't get out of hand in Europe and in the Middle East. So shockingly, at this current moment, there is not a single U.S. aircraft carrier in the Pacific Ocean. We usually keep a couple there, but they've sent them to war zones in other parts of the world, which means that if China wanted to get aggressive towards Taiwan or towards Japan or towards the Philippines, the U.S. would have to turn one of those aircraft carriers from the Indian Ocean around, and it would take several days for it to get there. Which is a problem, especially if you're in the Philippines or you're in Taiwan or you're in Japan. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Joe Flory, had an article he wrote about 8 years ago talking about China's steering the world towards war, just really highlighting China's efforts to take over the South China Sea. And he highlighted a shocking statistic that about one third of global trade goes through the South China Sea at some point. And so if China's shipbuilding capacity is 232 times greater than America's shipbuilding capacity, and it's militarizing the South China Sea, and America doesn't even have an aircraft carrier in the South China Sea at the moment, we're entering a dangerous era where America still is undecidedly the world's greatest naval power, but its naval power is not as great that it can defend every maritime choke point simultaneously. We're just hoping China is going to be nice because we don't actually have the resources to deal with that at the moment, which means, like you said, you start getting too many crises, and now all of a sudden you start getting trade routes shut down, which is going to have massive economic repercussions, not just in the United States, but around the world.
And that's where that historical perspective that you put that in the start is really important. Like, all of this sounds really familiar with British history, where Britain always tried to maintain a navy bigger than the previous several navies combined. And it was when that started to slip, like, that heralded the end of the British Empire. Whoever dominates the seas for the last 500-600 years has just about always been the most powerful, the richest, the most prosperous country. And we're looking at the end of that status for America. So that historical context sounds a major warning here, but so does the prophetic context.
Yeah, the prophetic context is major as well. There's a really amazing and inspirational statement in Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, where he zooms in on a prophecy, a promise God made to the patriarch Abraham. That he said, if you follow my laws, he's like, I'm going to make your descendants as numerous as the sand of the sea and as numerous as the stars of the heavens, and they will possess the gates of their enemies. That book talks about how, like, in a city, a gate is just the way you get into the city. But when you're dealing globally or continentally, the gates are the sea gates. It's gates like Panama is a gate, and Gibraltar is a gate, and Hormuz is a gate. And for most of the past 200 years, either Britain or America has controlled all of those gates. And so Mr. Armstrong, he made the point that he said, if you didn't know anything about the lost tribes of Israel or where they migrated through Scythia or where they migrated through all this. If you didn't know anything about the lost tribes of Israel, other than God said they would control the sea gates in the end time, you could use that fact alone to deduce which ethnic group is descended from ancient Israel. It was America and Britain have been the only powers so far in world history that controlled all of the sea gates from Singapore through Panama. And so there's other proofs that America and Britain are descended from ancient Israel, but you wouldn't even necessarily need those other proofs if you just understood the prophecy about the sea gates. But then, more soberingly, in like Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 27, these are the blessings and cursings chapters, it mentions that If America and Britain disobeyed God, they would lose control of these sea gates and their enemies would use them against them. So just like the fact that America and Britain possessed these gates proved that they're from ancient Israel, the fact that they're losing them shows that they've disobeyed God and are being punished for it. Like I said, China's actually owned the toll booths on the Panama Canal for some years now. They don't necessarily have the military power yet to outpower the U.S. Navy in the Caribbean, but they arguably do have the military power to power the U.S. Navy in the South China Sea. So that's one sea that's pretty much already lost to the American Navy. You're going to see America lose more and more of these gates until it gets to a point where America's enemies can actually start working together to besiege it economically. And there's other Bible prophecies in Ezekiel 5 primarily, Ezekiel 4 and 5, that talks about that it's actually that economic siege, the full-blown economic siege, according to Ezekiel 4, will last 390 days, that weakens America so much that it can actually be invaded militarily. There's a couple chapters in their editor-in-chief's book, Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet, that go through, one's titled Superpowers Under Siege, the other's titled Terrorism and Race Riots, that actually go through blow by blow how those curses unfold, and even down to the day of how long those sieges will last. But before the siege can start, America's Navy needs to be weakened to the point where our enemies can control the sea gates. And if we only have 280 ships and China's shipbuilding capacity is 232 times greater than ours, it won't be long before we just can't keep up. Yeah, so as far as other big news stories in the Anglo-American region, I do want to give a little bit of rundown on the political news. Special Counsel Jack Smith has actually fired a superseding indictment against United States President Donald Trump, again trying to accuse him of trying to overturn the 2020 presidential election. So the legal lawfare against Donald Trump is still going very hard and heavy. Yet there is some good news for Trump on the legal front. The United States Supreme Court voted this week to uphold an Arizona law that requires voters to present proof that they're citizens before they vote in elections. So hopefully that will cut on election fraud in Arizona in the 2024 presidential election. Another piece of good news for Donald Trump is independent candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has decided to suspend his campaign in several swing states and endorse the Trump campaign. So that's some much needed support for Donald Trump, even from a moderate Democrat.
Well, thank you for that, Andrew. Thank you to all of our panelists today. Thank you very much for you, the viewer, for joining us. Thank you to George Haddad and Isaac Lorenz for engineering and production. If you have any questions, comments on anything that we've covered on today's show, we'd be very happy to hear from you at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. Please do give us a like, subscribe, or leave a comment on YouTube or Rumble, wherever you are viewing this. And as always, we'll have links to those critical pieces of literature that we mentioned that will help you prove to yourself that all of this is happening in the context of God's plan for mankind, that these events are not just random chaos. And so there is tremendous hope in studying that for yourself. We want to help you do that. We'll put links down into the show notes. We'll be back on Wednesday. Until then, keep watching your world.